Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, our next guest here on Guitar Radio Show is asking you to heed the boogaloo. Can you dig it? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Mr. Greg Koch. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me on again.
It's a pleasure to have you as always. You are a blast, and I love this new record.
I'm so glad you dig it. I am very excited about the whole shebang.
Well, you know what? This is a whole nother thing. You know, I always love getting a great record, but I also love when there is a great story behind the record, the impetus of this record. And I want to explore that with you. Today we're going to be going track by track through the new record called Toby Arrives.
Yes.
And it's on the Mascot label. Folks, go to gregkoch.com. That's K-O-C-H .com. And you can read all about it. And you can get it anywhere you can download music. And I imagine there's somewhere you can actually get a physical copy of it somewhere.
Yes, they also did vinyl as well.
Oh, that's great. That's cool. Liner notes. Neat.
Yes. The whole shebang.
Wow, this is great. So this is a trio record, and it's you on guitar, obviously, your son Dylan on drums, and Toby Lee Marshall on a very, very aggressive B3.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So aggressive. Tell us about this. How'd this whole thing get started?
Well, it was a total fluke, to be honest. I mean, I had just, I think I had just sent off my Unrepentant record off to be duplicated, and I had a tour booked of Europe with a version of the Tone Controls, and my son had been coming up to Minneapolis, which is about 5 hours away from here, from beautiful Milwaukee. He'd been going up there to do some gigs with this young guitar player up there named Dylan Sulfur. And my Dylan would come back all the time saying, "Dad, you got to hear this B3 player that we've been playing with." I'm like, "Well, who is this guy?" He's like, "Well, he's this guy that Dylan Sulfur found. He lives in Ribbon Falls. He used to play with Bernard Allison, yada, yada, yada." And I'm like, "Well, that's great. Cool." I mean, but I'm thinking in my head, "Well, that's up in Minneapolis. What good does that do me?" You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So one day Dylan says to me, "Hey, Dad, Toby, the B3 player, he's actually coming down to Milwaukee. He's buying a Leslie speaker from this guy, John Kames, who's the son of this guy, Bob Kames, who's the big Hammond dealer in town here for years on end. And he says, we should really get together and jam with Toby." And I'm like, yeah. When I'm home off the road, I've got to do a million different, you know, errands that I'm doing, mm-hmm. and schedule stuff. And so jamming with my son's friends for the hell of it is not something that is, shall we say, on the forefront of my mind. So it was getting closer and closer to when this Toby was going to be in town. So finally, it's like the Wednesday before the Thursday he's going to be in town. And Dylan says to me, "Dad, Toby's coming in town tomorrow. What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, you know what? We got the keyboard in the basement. There's drum set down there. Why don't we just, when he comes over, we'll just go downstairs and jam for a while." He's like, "Dad, he's not going to play that piece of shit. He plays B3. I'm like, "Well, what do you suggest?" He says, "Well, I think we should bring the B3 in the front room here, move the furniture around, and we should jam." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, your mom's really going to dig that, though. She'll be all over it." So then I said, let me kind of fish it around in my brain a little bit. But still, I was preoccupied with other things. So now it's Thursday morning. Dylan's going, at that time he was bagging beans at this coffee roastery down the street. He's like, "Dad, I'm going to work. Toby's going to be here at 2:00. What are we doing?" I'm like, "Oh, shit. Well, let me see what I can do." So I called the studio where I know they have a B3 ready to rock. They had a drum set mic'd up and ready to go. I had no idea whether this guy was, if he was in town, if he was booked, what was going on. But he answered the phone. I said, "Hey, Steve, Dylan's got this B3 guy coming in town today. Do you mind if we come over there and make some noise around 2:30-ish? He's like, "No problem. Come over at 2:30. I'll have everything mic'd up, ready to go." And he goes, "I'll record it." I'm like, "Okay." So Toby comes to my house, and I say, "Hey, Toby, nice to meet you." Dylan says, "You're wicked." And Toby had admitted that he had a couple of my records and was kind of familiar with the routine and was looking forward to maybe jamming. And I said, "Well, let's go over to the studio and play a little bit. If we get some keepers, I'll throw you some dough and we'll make a record. So I remember I grabbed a Vibralux and I grabbed my Gibson Custom Shop, Greg Martin Les Paul that I had wired in that Peter Green wiring in the middle. That was kind of my little fun, you know, you go through little phases. I would take that guitar and go straight into that amp and just turn it up. So that's what I did. I grabbed that stuff. We went to the studio. I plugged in. Toby sits right behind the C3 that they had there, and it was ready to rock. And Dylan gets behind the drum set, starts making a little noise. And then Steve, the engineer, goes, well, we're ready to go. I'm like, great. I said, let's just do like a shuffle in G. So I counted it off, and the first tune on this record is that very first jam that we ever played. It was literally the first notes we ever played together in any kind of organized fashion was captured. And when we listened back, I was like, holy shit, we could release this. And so, and I didn't want to bury it either. I thought, no, that, we'll make that the first track because that's exactly what happened. And it was simply Toby arrives because he did.
Wow. And folks, that's the track you heard when we just started the show as we came in through the intro. That's the first track on the record. It's the title track on the record called Toby Arrives. That is amazing. Now, from what I understand, this cat had already retired from the business.
Well, Toby's, I think he just turned 40. So, you know, he's not exactly like an old timer by any stretch of the imagination. But
right.
He got married, had a couple young kids, and he decided that for the sake of his family unit that he wouldn't go on the road anymore. Because I guess, you know, Bernard Allison used to travel quite a bit. So Toby actually worked on a farm, and he moved to River Falls. River Falls is a town in Wisconsin that's just across the Minnesota border. You know, it's on the other side of the Minnesota border, about a half hour away from the Twin Cities. And he's got two young kids, and he was working on a farm. He was actually driving semi to the Twin Cities with crops. And the guy that ran the farm was a musician friend of his, so was sympathetic to the cause. And he was just thinking about getting back into music when this all kind of had come together. So it was pretty crazy. I mean, you know, it was one of those things when we played that first tune, and then when we played the second tune, on the record is actually the second tune we ever played. Then I brought the whole gang, you know, I brought him back like 2 weeks later, and then I flew in the video team from actually it was just the one guy, but he came in from the Wildwood video guys. He came in and filmed the whole thing, and of our second session, which was the bulk of the record. And I knew right away we had something, and I knew right away too that I didn't care that there were no vocals. That it was just, I thought it stood on musically on just the ground of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, intense three minds coming together as one type mm-hmm. of thing that mm-hmm. it didn't need anything else.
Yeah, there's a lot of telepathy going on for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the next track. The second track on the record is called Funk Meat. Two of my favorite things, funk and meat.
Delicious.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, actually, you know, when it comes to getting your sound in the studio, I know, like, for me at least, you know, I can sound one way live and I'm like, oh, this sounds great, you know, because I'm in a place where there's maybe there's enough headroom and there's really a lot going on and it's just gelling. But I find that sometimes when I get into the studio, all those same settings are like, forget about it. It doesn't sound good at all. Does it take you a long time to get where you need to be as far as settings?
You know what? What's interesting about this, literally I did nothing.
That's beautiful.
Especially for these first two songs. I mean, for the other stuff, I messed around a little, just a little bit. But my tendency is that whatever sound I get in that moment is, if I like it, and even I just say, well, that's what's meant to be for this track, and then I just go. So I don't really obsess too much about what's going on. And the less shit in line, the better for me. I mean, I like, especially for that first session, literally it was the Vibrolux, you know, mic closed and mic'd a little bit farther away to get a little room ambience. I always like to have a little bit of amp reverb on, and then I just cranked the amp and that was it. And then I just used the volume knob on the old guitar to turn down and get clean and turn it up for the filth. And I've recorded enough with that amp for the last going on 20 years now that I know happened. So it's not like it's a mystery. So it's almost foolproof that I know it's going to sound at least in the ballpark.
And that's the Les Paul on there, right?
That is. On those first two songs, it's the Les Paul, yeah.
Yeah, and no pedals. Just straight in.
No pedals. That's correct.
Good God. Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, the sound is just so there. And that's great. I mean, I love when stuff like that happens. You just plugged in, you said it, and you went for it, and it sounded fantastic. That's fantastic. I love it.
Well, I like the surprises. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, happy accidents.
You listen back, you're like, well, that works.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that was just a jam, too, and that turned into something else?
Well, the second tune, after we had played the shuffle, and then I just said, well, let's do something of a syncopated orientation. And I said, let's do like a funk thing and see. And so I just started playing that little opening thing, and the guys just came in, and that just happened. And I didn't feel the need for any chord change, or we just kept it there on the one. And again, I messed around with a couple of little melodic themes in there, just kind of off the cuff, and they seemed to work. And then when we listened back, I'm like, well, shit. I mean, we didn't edit it, nothing. We just, there it is, you know? Wow. And, you know, when I listened back, now in that first session, we had done kind of embryonic versions of some of the tunes that we would cover in the second session. You know, we did a little bit of Let's Get Sinister, and we did a version of Heed the Boogaloo, which actually we could have released, but they would have had to have been edited a little bit.
Right.
But the second, you know, the versions we did a couple weeks later were a little bit, you know, were much more savage, so we kept those in. But, yeah, that first day, I mean, I listened back, you know, because Steve gave us a CD right then and there, and we listened to it. Like, or actually later that day, he sent us a Dropbox link, and we listened to it. We're like, holy shit. So we started conspiring immediately as to what we were going to do, and that we needed to play in this unit as much and as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and there was only two sessions to get to.
Correct.
Wow, amazing.
We'll be right back.
heard him play the first time I listened to the record, I was like, oh, that's got to be like a Fender P bass.
Right? Yeah, it's crazy.
They brought in a bass player for this. That's what, you know, or Greg went ahead and he just did bass parts here. But no, as you really listen very closely, like, oh wow, that is really,
yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So Heed the Boogaloo.
Yes.
This is a funky R&B, just throaty. This has got to be a Telecaster.
Oh, that absolutely.
Yeah.
So on the whole second session, I used my Tele, and then I actually brought in several amps, mm-hmm. Which were all going at the same time, which was the Vibralux, a Fender Pro Junior, and a Friedman Small Box 50 on the clean channel,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't really that clean when you turn it up, of course. And I couldn't even tell you what the balance is between the three amps, but I brought in this pedal called the Triple Gristle, which is my buddy Tim Yarning for years has made a pedal for me called the Gristle King, which has a overdrive on it and a clean boost. The Triple Gristle has a fuzz on it, and it's a fuzz that he came up with, which is a variation. It's not a, you know, it's not like your he uses something different other than either a silicon or a what's the other
germanium
one? Germanium,
yeah.
it's neither of those. It's something different that he uses to get the fuzz.
Hmm.
And it's fat and it's fuzzy, but it doesn't get the AM radio thing. You know what I mean?
yeah
but what it does do is I had the clean boost and the fuzz on all the time, and then I would just use the volume control on on the Telecaster.
Yeah.
So for all of the rest of the tunes, that's what's on.
Plus that Tele is equipped with Fishman's, right?
Yeah, that's got my signature Tele pickups on there, so it's dead quiet. And then it also has that little boost on, which I don't think I used.
Right.
Because it was already so filthy that I didn't really need
right.
to boost anything up.
But it's so, I love when you take a Telecaster and you push it, you know, you push it to that threshold, and it gets
yes.
so throaty. It's so different than a Les Paul, and
yes.
you know, or obviously a Strat. But yeah, this particular track, Heed the Boogaloo, has got so much throat. It's vocal. Yeah.
You know, what's interesting about that tune is, you know, when I did that record a few years back called Plays Well With Others, I wrote all these songs with this really good singer-songwriter of town here named John Seeger. And we've literally got, I think it's 70 tunes that are backlogged.
Whoa.
And vocal tunes. But a lot of those vocal tunes, I really liked the instrumental version that I came with. Not that John's part isn't great, but when I was looking at doing, and there are some of those tunes I wanted to do as instrumentals.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of them. This was actually a tune that he had wrote lyrics to, but the demo I sent him was basically what you're hearing. I mean, it was just me doing and then that melody on the top of it, and I just said to Toby when we were about to play it, I was like, you know, this is just it's a boogaloo, I said, but think Changeling, you know, the Doors, you know. And him and I were like, oh, I love that song, you know. So he was all in. So, you know, away we went. And yeah, it was one of those things where, you know, in the past, you know, when I would do instrumental songs, not that I was obsessed with a level of complexity, but there were always things in there that really had to be worked out, you know, lines and hit and kicks and all that other kind of shit. Whereas these tunes, although there is a certain level of complexity, they're pretty much straightforward jam tunes. And this is one of them where it's just, you know, it's a little different from a 12-bar blues, but by the same token, you know, I could show it to them in about 5 minutes and then mm-hmm. we were off to the races. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a total pocket song. I mean, and Dylan is holding down the groove beautifully. It's and the way that his, you know, Toby's feet are working with Dylan's groove, it gives you all of that room, all of that,
yes.
all of that air to, you know, start painting. Yeah, I want
to
paint.
To unleash the beast.
It's beautiful. It really is. A great track.
Well, thank you.
I love that track. All right, let's get sinister, literally and figuratively. Let's talk about this track. Now, here's the thing I noticed about this track and a couple of other tracks on the record, like the Boogie Yourself, Drady. Is it Drady?
Yeah, Drade.
Okay.
There's a story there. We'll get to that.
Yeah, there's this with tracks like those, particularly like Let's Get Sinister, you know, you have this wonderful way of hinting at your influences, you know, just for a little bit, and then all of a sudden you take us off-road. You know, we start four-wheeling with you, and we're, you know, and you go places that those influences of yours would either wouldn't go or couldn't go. And that's what you did on Let's Get Sinister.
Yes.
What's going on, man? Tell me about it.
Well, you know, I love shuffles, and Dylan's a shuffle demon. Mm-hmm. And I knew, and I love the sound when a B3 locks into a shuffle. I love that shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, this tune also, it's just the chord changes just speak to being able to take it a little bit out. So it has this bona fide, real dirty shuffle thing that's not, you know, that's as greasy as it gets, but yet it hints at, you know, some harmony that could be thrown in to take it a little bit out. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it tune kind of epitomizes the approach of this band is the fact that it's, you know, it's got the, you know, it's rooted in filth. You know what I mean? I mean, what I mean by that is, like, you know, there's this old school rock, blues, funk thing and soul jazz, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only real nod to modernity is is maybe a little bit more of a leaning on a different harmonic twist.
Mm-hmm.
On throwing some outside stuff in there. And for me, when I was doing this melody, I was thinking Albert Collins, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, with having the fuzz on, it also, you know, it allows you to go in places that are, you know, Hendrixian or Roy. The thing I love about Hendrix and Roy Buchanan is that there's places where it doesn't sound like a guitar. It sounds like the end of the world, people shrieking and you know, the gates of Mordor being opened up or whatever you want to call it. And both of those things kind of come to fore in the song. And, you know, and when I take things out, I mean, I can explain what I'm doing. So if someone goes, well, when you take it out, what are you doing? At the time I'm doing it, I'm not thinking to myself, well, right now I'm going to start a half step below and I'm going to, you know, allude to this pentatonic scale over this particular other pentatonic, or maybe I'll throw a melodic minor here. There's going to be a little bit of whole tone in there for good measure and a little sprinkling of diminished. It all just kind of happens in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all kind of done because it feels like it's the right way to add a little bit of excitement at that point to just kind of go, what the fuck was that?
Mm-hmm.
If I would do that, obviously, throughout the entire song from beginning to end, it wouldn't have the same effect. So with this kind of a format, when you can throw that thing in for just a split second, it has a much more visceral impact.
Oh, without a doubt. It catches the ear, and also it'll do one of two things to the listener. It'll either say, oh, shit, I really need to practice, or I quit.
Well, what's interesting is I just think that for the non-musician, they're just like, you know, it has that same, I mean, that's one of the differences between, I think, like, and this is just obviously my opinion, it's not by not me, I'm saying, this is the way it is. But I think one of the reasons why, you know, a guy like Roy Buchanan, or Hendrix had much more of an impact on the average listener as opposed to the musician listener is because that they could add in this other stuff, but it just sounded cool to the non-musician without going, oh my, you know what I mean? It just has it's maybe a less mathematical approach and more just kind of this spur of the moment. Freneticism.
Yeah,
that causes a reaction.
I think you're right for sure. And then also, that I think there was the component for Jimmy in that particular time that he graced the planet. You know, there was a lot of sex in his music.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, it was it was very hormonal.
Yes. And let's not forget the whole psychedelic thing. I mean,
exactly.
Was, I mean, the focus of the times and the music was actually trying to communicate with a more enhanced state of being, mm-hmm. as opposed to where's the hookers and blow.
Right, right, exactly.
Which were part of the journey apparently at one point, but that, you know, they were more of you know,
right.
sideline issues as
yeah.
opposed to the, the main goal.
Yeah, no, it was about the freak flag. It was a whole different thing.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. So speaking of psychedelic,
yes,
Misterioso. This is such a left turn, man, on the record. I love it. When I heard it the first time, I was like, oh wow! Now he took us into the basement, you know. and there's blacklight posters.
Yes. Yes.
So
well, what's interesting about this? I've done a demo on this. You know, what's interesting is I don't have a home studio. Whenever I do demos, I literally do them in GarageBand,
mm-hmm.
and I use the mic on the Mac, on my MacBook Pro.
Really?
I put my iPod, my iPhone earphones into the thing to be able to listen mm-hmm. back and play along and layer stuff. And that's how I document all my songs. And this one I had lurking for a while, and I have them all in this folder in iTunes. And most of them I would send to John Seeger, and he would write lyrics to. But there are some that he didn't write lyrics to, and there's other stuff that just I never sent him. So I've got, you know, I don't know how many tunes are there, but there's a shit ton. So if I load everything into my iPhone, I'll be on my walk or whatever, you know, on a plane or something, and I'll have my phone on shuffle, and these tunes will just come on, and I'll be like, holy shit, I forgot about this one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that happened to me at some point right around the time that Toby arrived, and I thought, well, this would be kind of fun to suss this one out in a band format. And that's basically what happened. I was like, here, check this out. You know, it drones these chords, and it goes to this place. And other than that, it's just a jam. And I kind of gave him some ideas for, well, over these chords, you can just kind of look at it like this, or you can look at it as playing this chord over that chord. And we just went for it. And then Dylan came up with that cool drum intro and that groove. And so we're like, well, let's let the good times roll. And then I thought it'd be kind of cool to do some, you know, Truxian slide in there at some
yeah.
point, you know, kind of doing that East Indian flavored activity.
Mm-hmm. And what's
so,
is that
also kind of a nod to Frank Zappa too, because it's a Lydian, you know, it's a Lydian onslaught.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was kind of thinking of a little like one of those long one chord jams that Zappa would do in Lydian land. It's
uh-huh.
kind of influenced by that as well.
Do you have a favorite Zappa solo?
you know what's weird for me is it's not what you would think. My favorite Zappa solo is actually on the live version of Trouble Every Day Live at the Roxy and Elsewhere. When he breaks into the, you know, and in your dreams you can see yourself, you know, that's when it goes into that, and right after Cheapness, you know, when they go into that long, slower version of that tune.
Yeah.
And he unleashes a solo and he bends this one note, and that's the coolest thing in the world for me when he does that. So that's actually my favorite solo that he does.
I really think that someday we're going to look back, people are going to look back on Zappa and they're going to, you know, like for me, I'm still trying to figure it out. You know, from a palate standpoint, I'm like, wow. I'll go back and I'll listen to stuff and I'll go, okay, I'm not ready. I'll go back. I'll come back. And I'll go back
Well, it's interesting because it's you know, what's interesting to me about it is that, you know, there's so much material.
Yeah.
And I find myself gravitating towards the groovier stuff, and you know, and a lot of that is too is with the records that I had, you know, when I was a kid from my older siblings that had them. But you know, Overnight Sensation, Live at the Roxy and Elsewhere, and Apostrophe are my three favorites.
Yeah.
You know, as time, and of course, I love Joe's Garage and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But as time got on, the rhythm sections and stuff weren't quite as groovy as those earlier iterations. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, you gravitate towards different points. But, you know, it's crazy because there's so much material that it's hard to digest it all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. For me, my favorite time was when Bozio was in the band. You know, Zootalures and
I definitely love Zootalures too. That was another glorious activity.
But that's great. You gave a little nod to Mr. Z.
Yes.
Titles to songs, and I'm always like, what the hell? What the hell? You know, Pat Metheny said that he hates titling his music because he doesn't want to create a visual imprint in people's minds about what the music's about. So,
yes.
So Enter the Rats?
Yes. Well, literally, we got done tracking that song, and I had my eyes closed, and we got done playing the song, and it was all one, too. Basically, it was just a jam. It was that shuffle-ish tune going into the boogie tune.
Right.
And after we got done, they said, did you see the rats go through here? I go, what are you talking about? I'm like, two rats just went through here as we were playing that song. What are you talking about? Steve have rats? Well, it turns out, you know, my son's girlfriend at the time had pet rats, and she walked through the studio as we were recording that song, and she had this little cage with the rats in it. So I called it Enter the Rats.
That's funny.
And that was that. But yeah, I just thought, hey, let's just jam around. And I made up the head on the spot, and you know, away we went. Mm-hmm. I think we did a version of it the day before, and then we did it the day after as well. And I said, just a variation of this head. And we recorded that, and then went right into the boogie tune.
And that's on a telly. Are you using that fuzz again, or?
Yes. Yeah. That's that fuzz on that telly, which just sounds like the end of the world.
So for the most part, you pretty much set everything and left it.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's so great. That is so great. Oh, I mean, and then you could just focus on the playing. That's great.
Exactly. It's like, this is the particular timbre for this record. This is what I'm doing, and I'm just going to concentrate on the playing now and fuck it. That's basically what
I said. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. This next track, now this also lends to what I said earlier about, you know, you hint at influences and stuff like that, but then you go some places that those influences probably wouldn't go. I love this track. I tried to figure out this opening riff, and I'm like cursing you out this morning, and so this is called Boogie Yourself. Now, is it Drod or Dre?
Dreed. Dreed. Well, what happened was I've been doing this little joke for years because my nephew, who's now 32 years old or whatever, but when he was a little kid, I'd come home from college and he would be at my folks' house, his grandparents' house, and I would have to babysit this kid all the time.
Uh-huh.
And we used to do this little thing where I would just, you know, when he would be too wild and crazy, I would look at him and I'd go, "Silence, child!" And he would look at me, and he couldn't say his G's right. So he would say them as D's. And he would stop what he was doing and look at me and dig at me and go, "Silence yourself, Drade." And so over the years, I will just kind of, you know, whatever anybody says, like, "Hey, turn the light off." I'll go, "Turn the light off yourself, Drade." And so when we were doing the boogie series, like, "Is that a boogie?" I was like, "Boogie yourself, Drade." And that's basically.
Oh my god. So what was that? Was that an off the cuff riff too, or was that something you had in the can?
Well, that was kind of an off the cuff riff. I had been doing kind of a slower, funkier version live of a tune of my chicken picking tune called Spank It. And at the end of it, I would go into a boogie tune. And we would do a variation of, you know, the Magic Sam Looking Good tune, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I would do a variation of the finger picking pattern to make it a little bit more funky, kind of a chicken pickety version of that riff. And then finally, I would allude to kind of that riff. So when we were, and I was like, "Let's do a boogie version," but I'm not gonna do the Magic Sam riff. I'm gonna come up with something of my own. And so I came up with that. I just kind of refined it in the moment, and away we went. So it's definitely a nod to the, you know, the Freddie King boogie, or the, you know, the Magic Sam, kind of those West Side Chicago guys. I guess they had to have their boogie tune that they would do in the key of A.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of my nod to that thing, with, you know, of course, Billy Gibbons on the way, and whatever, and the Hendrixian fuzz of doom.
So is that a track you're going to do live?
Yeah, so at the end of, when we get done with Spank It, so we do this tune Spank It, which is this up-tempo, you know, country onslaught that I would always do. But now with this band, we kind of do it a little slower and a little funkier. And at the end, I would always used to go into kind of a medley, There's a thing on YouTube where I used to do this long medley of, at the end of Spankin', I would go into the Zeppelin bit and do all this crazy shit, kind of a not, and then do like a chicken picket version of Stairway to Heaven and all this kind of
scrapple. Yeah, I think I've seen that, actually. Yes, I remember that.
And I just don't want to do that anymore. I do it here and there, but I thought, well, let's do something a little different. So at the end of Spankin', we go into this this boogie tune. And so that's what we've been doing as of late. So we actually don't even do the first part. The Enter the Rats kind of gets lost in the shuffle, and we do Spank It, and then we go into the boogie yourself, great. And then in the period of the boogie yourself.
Hello, you there?
And then at that point, I might allude, you know, small illusions as opposed to like full blown. You know, I go into a little bit of Funk 49. Mm-hmm. You know, do that middle section where you have that savage riff of doom.
Yeah,
and then, you know, the kids just love that stuff. The kids, they eat it up.
That would be me.
Woo!
Yes, sir.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, sir. You round the record out with a track that I believe is that an open E tuning that you're in here?
No, that's actually standard tuning.
That's a standard tuning? All right, so I got to pick your brain here. The track is called
Yes.
Sin, Repent, Repeat. Sounds
yes.
like sounds like my life.
Yes, of course.
So
it's the way of the middle way.
So tell me, how is this? This is that whole Dwayne-esque
yes.
method of muting and picking and muting and picking, and in a standard tuning.
That's correct.
Okay, so hit me.
Well, this is I'd had kind of the chords for this tune for a while, and I would do them as kind of a little chord melody thing. Before I would launch into another tune, and I would just do kind of a solo guitar thing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, it'd be cool to do it with a band. And so I kind of came up with the arrangement, and then I thought, well, it'd be cool to play slide over the top, because I was unsure of whether I wanted it to be a chord melody thing or have it be like this, because the chord melody stuff was so cool that I thought, well, you know, I'll miss out on those cool inversions. If I just have, you know, especially prior to that with a guitar-based drum scenario, it would kind of get lost in the shuffle. So once we had Toby involved and he was doing those chords, I was like, well, shit, because he totally gets that whole gospel, imbued way of manipulating the B3s. So mm-hmm. once he had those chords covered, then I could really kind of concentrate on coming up with a melody thing with the slide. Problem is that the melody I came up with was such a pain in the ass that when we first tried tracking it, I just couldn't come up with the performance I was satisfied with. Mm-hmm. So when this particular record we had finished, and I had actually had copies printed on my own because I was going to release it myself, and in the process of from the time we had sent it off to get duplicated and the time we received them, we ended up getting the deal with Mascot. So the initial recording of Toby Arrives did not have this tune on it. So when we got signed, we thought, well, to differentiate it from the version we came out with, you know, we I honored the pre-sales that we had done in September of last year, and there was, I can't remember how many of them, but I thought, well, if any of those people want to buy the actual released version, we got to change it some way. So we remastered everything, and then we added this tune. So this particular track we had tracked actually last summer. All the rest of the stuff was done in March of last year. So this particular tune we had tracked in the summer. I think it was in June.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a performance that I just thought worked better. So that was done in a different studio. And I actually used my 53 Tele on that song. But the melody, slide-wise, a year ago, let's see, a year and a half ago, going up 2 years ago now, I figured out a way to do all that Derek Trucksy stuff because it was really frustrating me. His intonation just was too good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually one of the only guitar lessons I've taken in the last God knows how many years I took from Jack Pearson because I went and saw his slide playing. I was like, what the fuck is going on here? So
right.
He kind of described the way that he looked at intonation is that a lot of times what he would do is he would play things in standard fingering with his left hand, and then he would duplicate them right afterwards with the slide to just kind of, you know, calibrate his intonation. And uh-huh. So I was doing that, and that made sense. But then when you listen to Derek do it, Derek does all of these, you know, East Indian things, and he does those, you know, kind of the sacred steel, you know, that Robert Randolph, Aubrey Gantt school of, you know, doing that gospely stuff with these really fast, you know, vocal lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I sat down and I was trying to figure out this Derek was like one of those East Indian tunes. I can't remember the name of it, but and at first I was just going to, because I'd been doing some of those slide inflections without the slide and just kind of doing them with bends. And that's what I was going to do I'll figure out one of those tunes and just do it with my fingers. And then as I was listening to it more, I was like, what the hell is he doing? There's got to be something going on here because no one can just have intonation that good. Yeah. There's just no way. Right. So that's what I was thinking. And maybe he does, and that's just the end of it. But what I figured, what you can do is you actually fret with the slide for a split second to check your intonation. And that way you can do all those fast runs. And so when I do that, you know, for a split second, every one of those notes, I'm actually pressing down with the slide to check my intonation. And then once I check it, then I bring the slide up over the fret net, vibrato, or do whatever I got to do.
So
it's a combination of fretting for a split second with the slide.
Okay, so help me
understand.
Help me to understand that. So when you say you're fretting with it, now is the action a little bit higher than normal, or is it?
No, it's just standard how my guitar is set up for everything else. So I just grab my slide and literally just press down like I'm actually using it as a finger mm-hmm. on the fretboard
mm-hmm.
for a split second. And then I can, you know, go, you know, obviously lessen the pressure off and just do conventional slide stuff to get up to a note. But if I, you know, there's those things where he does where he goes way up the neck and his intonation is spot on.
I'm like,
well, that's impossible because you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's not impossible because he's doing it. So, but for me, in order to make it possible, I thought, well, there's got to be a way to check your intonation for a split second there, because then we're just talking about almost a supernatural muscle memory that allows him to be in intonation everywhere on the neck at any time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, it seems like it really demands an incredible sense of subtlety.
Yes. Well, yes, absolutely.
Because you can't dig in, because you'll be hitting the fret wire.
Exactly. You just got to do it. I mean, and that's what was fucking me up at first. Because when I first started doing this, I was, you know, you could hear the the vocoder kind of aspect of hearing the fret go by, the little glissando.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to work it up to the point where you can't hear it. Now, even now, I have to, you know, warm up a little bit, but it's really starting to come together where I can kind of do it at will now. Because it was taking me forever to get a decent take of that song because mm-hmm. it's just so fucking hard to make it happen.
Yeah.
But after a period of time, I'm like, well, there it is. And so now I can grab the slide with no warm up and do all the stuff.
That's insane. That's insane.
It's cool. It's been cool for me because it's always been a voice that I really, really wanted to have in the arsenal.
Uh-huh.
Cause I would hear Derek do those cool melodic lines that were like a vocalist, you know what I mean? And either like and it was ghastly, right? I mean, I remember when I got that record years ago that came out, the Sacred Steel stuff, where like Aubrey Gantt and those, and the Robert Randolph School, you know, where they're doing those lines. And now you can, you know, with pressing down the slide, you can actually hit that stuff. No, obviously the guys in the lap steel are just doing it by ear, so they're doing it by muscle memory. So, Derek could well be doing that himself, although I can swear I can hear the frets going by. But, you know, he says he's not doing it, and I'm taking him as, not that it's a big deal one way or the other. I'm just saying to folks, hey, you know what? You can do it by pressing down for a split second with a slide and in check your intonation, and it really adds a cool aspect of playing slide that prior to this would seem like you needed almost a supernatural sense of muscle memory and muscle control in order to have your intonation be so perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I got to try that. And when I see you in Dallas, you've got to show me. Will you show me?
I will. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I've got to see this. I can visualize by what you're saying, and I'm going to try it, but I have a feeling I'll fall flat. We'll see. Yeah, I'm going
to
give it a shot.
It's really cool. I mean, it allows you to do – I mean, it's funny because I put out a book with Hal Leonard. It's a book video on standard tuning slide, and there was a bunch of stuff I was already doing. And one of the things I mentioned in the book was fretting with the slide, but I was doing it more like with glissandos, you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
where you could actually hear the frets going by. And it wasn't – the book was already – done and recorded, and then I started messing around and figuring out that you could actually play these notes with just a real subtle split second pressing mm-hmm. down on the slide on the fretboard to check your intonation to do these lines, and so it kind of became a whole other thing. So
that's great. That's so cool. I can't wait to, when we get done, I'm gonna go try that.
Excellent.
So we're looking at a tour.
Well, we're certainly getting things fired up to, you know, with the label, you know, there's talk about hooking us up with an agent in the States. I've never had a booking agent in the States. You know, the funniest thing is you can talk to most artists and they'll tell you getting a record deal is almost child's play as opposed to getting a decent agent. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just me. Maybe people just don't like me. But it has been impossible over the years to get people to give a shit enough to book the band, which just seems so odd, but it is what it is. So now I'm finding out that, you know, I'm kind of putting the stuff together myself, and we have been working with different people that are going to help us out. But the record company's supposed to, I think what might happen is it's been mentioned that maybe we'll piggyback and do some gigs with some other artists.
Cool.
You know, there's been talk about maybe Lando and me going out in some kind of way, shape, or form. I certainly would be up for that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard back whether that's going to take place or not. But in Europe, I've had an agent for years. So there it's a little less of a hassle to book stuff. But, you know, we're trying, and of course, the label's very much interested to elevating this thing up to the level where, you know, we're playing all the major cities throughout America and Europe and everywhere else. And that, you know, hopefully will be, you know, North Sea Jazz Festival, you know, Montreux Jazz Fest, all the, you know, Montreux, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Because this thing can fit in a way where, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Could it work at a blues festival? Yes. Could it work at a jazz festival? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We could be with any jam band.
Yeah.
And rock it. You know what I mean? So there are I have no doubt that all we have to do, and I keep on telling my son and Toby too, is like, look, all we have to do is keep showing up and doing what we're going to do, and everything's going to work out just fine.
Well, it's so true. I mean, it's like anything. It's even like this show. You know, you stick around long enough, and people are going to say, oh yeah, that's right, those guys.
Exactly. That's it. You just got to keep doing the do.
That's just tenacity, man. That's what it is. So you're going to be at the Dallas Guitar Festival in May.
Absolutely, we'll be at Dallas. We're going to be in Texas that whole week doing some stuff. We're going to be at the Guitar Sanctuary again that following week. We're going to be down in Austin. We'll certainly be at all the dates will be on my website at gregkoch.com. But
cool.
you know, we'll be at most likely at Sweetwater Gear Fest, and we'll be at Summer NAMM. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to do a gig someplace down there during Summer NAMM as well, which would be great because I've never played in Nashville with my band ever. Well, I take that back. Back in the day, you know, we would do Fender things, like we did a couple things at the Wild Horse Saloon,
right?
And those were huge gigs for us because that's where a lot of people first found out about, you know, the band and me and all that other kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't actually played in Nashville with a band of mine in 10 years.
Oh, wow.
which is weird. But, you know, it's just kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, I got no complaints because I've been able to make, you know, a decent living playing my guitar for years. And I've been in Nashville, of course, doing clinics and this, that, and the next thing. Mm-hmm. But, or in all these other different towns, you mm-hmm. know, but... You know, like the band's never played in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's stuff like this. You mm-hmm. know, it just seems a little odd. So we're planning on rectifying all of that with this band.
That's cool. That's so cool. And I can't wait for you to do the Nashville show because it's going to be really interesting to see who shows up.
Yes.
You know, to get to scrutinize.
Well, we shall see. You know, it's always interesting when I run into guys that are, you know, name players and it's just flattering. They come up and say, you know, I've learned this and this and this from you. Like, really? That's crazy.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean I talk to people about you all the time. They go, yeah, yeah, you know this one thing he does on Sweet Tea? I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I stole that. I stole that too. So tell us what's going on with your signature amp.
Well, that was a totally cool thing. So about, I think about 3 years ago or so, I was actually at Music Mesa for Fishman. Mm-hmm. And because for years I went there doing Fender stuff. Mm-hmm. But this particular year I was just doing a Fishman thing. And we were set up across from where the Kalk amplifier booth was. And for years, I've always known about them because I knew they made great amps. I remember I was in Italy once doing a clinic at a music school, and the guy let me use his amp, and I really liked it. It was a Kalk, you know, twin tone or classic tone, one of the two. And so I kind of walked over to the booth, and Dolph Kalk and his wife came up and said, you know, we're fans of the band, and, you know, we're fans of yours. And I said, well, you know, wouldn't it be funny if we worked together? Because the name's right.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, well, why don't you check out one of our amps for the show? So I used a twin tone 3, and I used it in the booth, and I was jamming on it and doing a bunch of different stuff, and everyone was coming over and like, what is that amp? That thing sounds great. And Larry Fishman came over and was like, God, that amp sounds good. I'm like, yeah, it's great. So then we started talking, and then I started using their amps on tours that I would do over there. And then we were talking about maybe having some kind of relationship. I said, well, you know, what would you do for a signature amp? So then at NAMM, like 2 years ago, we started kind of nailing down what we would do. But they were busy with a bunch of different stuff that they had to get done and trying to get, you know, various aspects of their business ironed out because there was some some distribution and some manufacturing issues that needed to be ironed out. Make a long story short, finally it was on the docket to get the amp done. So last April, I had a prototype that I used, and I was like, oh my God, this is it. So basically what I wanted was, I always loved the way that their amps are set up. You know, their clean sound is a really spongy, glorious mm-hmm. clean sound that you can either make really loud and clean, mm-hmm. or you can have it get a little bit musty if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lead channel can either be a little bit broken up, and then you can add a gain boost on top of that to make it be a lot more overdriven. And for both channels, there's a rhythm volume and a lead volume. So it's totally usable. And the reverb's great. So you can have your clean sound with a boost, lead sound with a boost, and then a gain boost on top of that. Mm-hmm. So that was all stuff that really worked well for me. And I totally dug it, and it was voice great, and it sounded good at any volume. And so I said, the only difference that I would do for this amp would be that I would like the ability to be able to crunch up that clean sound a little bit more if I wanted to, so that I could just crunch it up and then use the volume on the guitar to back off and clean it up and turn it up and be more of like a block phase overdrive. I said, I would like the reverb to be a little bit more like a tank reverb. from back in the day, or what's on those Fender Vibro King amps, you know, where it's the three control reverb, the mix, the dwell, and the tone.
Right.
And then I'm a real fan of the old Brown era, or the Brown Tolex era Fender harmonic vibrato, which sounds actually more like a univibe. Mm-hmm. It was on those amps for just that period of time, and then Fender stopped doing it because it was too expensive to have on their amps. I said, so that's what I would like on the amp. Plus, I want 210s. I want a 210 combo because I love Vibroluxes. I love the sound of 210s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, then I want it to be Sonic Blue because that's my favorite, one of my favorite colors. So they were able to deliver. So what we decided to do is they came up with this idea for this OTS, which other amps manufacturers have done it in various different ways. But this OTS stands for Output Tube Saturation. So it's a control. So there's control panels on the front of the amp and on the top. So it's like the front of the amp, like a regular blackface Fender, and then on the top, like an AC30 or a Bassman, there's more controls. And people are like, "Oh, it's the, you know, there's too many knobs." It's actually pretty simple because it completely eliminates the need for a pedal board. Because on the top, this OTS thing has a gain and a tone, or actually a gain and an output. So it adds a half-watt power amp tube line level to either channel. So it's like having a tube screamer or a tube driver onboard your amp. Uh-huh. So I can add that to the clean sound, and when I have my amp set clean and I hit that control, it turns it into more of like a black-faced amp cranked. When I add that sound to my lead sound with the gain boost on, it actually sounds more like a fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the fuzz that I had on my Gristle King, but now it's on the amp. The reverb is totally glorious, and that three-control reverb is on the top of the amp, and then the controls for the harmonic vibrato are on the top as well. And there's a button that it goes from harmonic vibrato or can just be regular Fender tremolo. You can go between the two.
And there's a foot switch.
Okay. So the foot switch goes between clean and lead, OTS on and off, reverb on and off, and tremolo or vibrato on and off.
Oh, wow.
And it's in the way that they constructed the cabinet, it has tons of low end. So you get the tightness and focus of the 210s, mm-hmm. which are Jensen's, they're Jensen Falcon speakers, but it's got tons of low end. But it's got an open back because I love combos. So yeah. It doesn't really weigh that much. I mean, literally the weight when you pick it up, it's a little bit less than 50 pounds, but the way that the weight's distributed, it's not bad at all. Trust me, if it was bad, I would say, fuck, the thing's heavy as shit, but it's not.
Yeah.
And it sounds killer. It's either 25 or 50 watts. It's got EL34s, so it's got a half power switch or a full power switch. It's killer. So it's they had two at NAMM, two prototypes. They said, well, would you like to go home with one, or should we send one to Wildwood? Wildwood's very interested in having me use it for the videos because it solves a lot of problems
mm-hmm.
between clean and dirty, because we've been using like an AB rig. And so this would be the one amp that would be able to do both really well.
Right.
So I actually had them send it to Wildwood. So it's there as we speak. So I'm going to do my first couple of videos. I'm doing actually two video shoots in March out there. So I'll unleash it then.
Cool.
But it'll start shipping late March, early April. But we're going to have them at Wildwood. A bunch of different places around the country are going to be selling them. They're going to have them over in Europe. I know Andertons is going to be carrying them at Toman mm-hmm. and all the usual suspects. So
will you be touring with it?
Absolutely. As soon as I get one, well, I'll definitely have one in Europe when I go there in April.
Right.
And I'm hoping by the time May rolls around for me to go down to Texas, I'm hoping to have it as well.
That'd be cool. I'd like to hear that. I mean, I've seen video of you playing it, and it was pretty spectacular.
Oh, it's ridiculous. And it's a no-brainer, too. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, you just put a mic in front of it, and there it is.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do.
That's it, man. And the more I go forward... I'm still learning after all these years. I just want it simple. Give me simple.
Well, I should mention, as much as like we talked earlier about, I just used a cord and a guitar and an amp. Yeah, I love that approach, but there's nothing wrong with using pedals. Sometimes I like to use pedals.
It depends on the gig.
Exactly.
Right.
It depends on the gig.
Yeah.
But, I always... you know, it's one of those things too when people talk about why I use 13s on my guitar. I was like, well, if that works for you, great. But yeah, sometimes there's things you can't do with a guitar with 13.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You use what you need to use in the moment to make the music in the moment.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're tuning it down, if it's your 13s and you're tuning it down to a C, great.
Right. Or whatever. Maybe, you know, you've got Herculean fingers and that seems to work for you, but whatever, it's all of these things are just tools. But right, what's great about this amp is that it allows me, if I want to not have any pedals at all,
right,
I can plug in, and a lot of times when I'm using that amp, I'll use the second channel, the gain with the gain boost on and the OTS on, mm-hmm, and just use the volume control on the guitar, and it's like I have the fuzz on, so I can turn it down and it's clean as a whistle, turn it up, and it's like the end of the world. And the amp itself is very quiet. So when you have all the stuff on, like if I have my fuzz on, the amp's going, but this doesn't do that. It's very quiet.
Plus, so, you're dealing with the Fishmans, which are dead silent.
Exactly.
So,
which is all good.
That's great. That's great.
And now people always ask if I'm going to put the Fishmans on the 53 Tele, and no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, it's not because the Fishmans are great pickups. They're great pickups. As a matter of fact, that's the guitar that I tour with because I know that I'll be able to get all the sounds I want and be impervious to all the different destructions that might be awaiting. But the whole reason you buy an old guitar is because you want all those weird idiosyncrasies.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've got guitars that you say, no, this has to stay the way it is because that's the voice inside this instrument. You need to leave
exactly.
It. Exactly. Yeah, for sure.
Correct the mundo.
Yeah. Well, man, I got to tell you, you never disappoint. This is such a great record, and I wish you nothing but success with it. I think it's
going to... Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm glad you dig it.
Yeah, and this is a great way to start the year, you know. I'm saying, you know, between you and the new Landau record and the new Sue Foley record, I don't know if you've heard this yet.
No, I haven't.
Oh, man, is it good. It's produced by Mike Flanagan, and, you know, he's a B3 player, and I told him recently, I said, you know what? I says, as good a B3 player as you are, and he is, I said, people are going to start looking to you as a producer because he produced the record. It is, you know, like some of those old Buddy Guy records with that deepness, you know, and the old B.B. King records and stuff like, it's got that feel. It's, you know how some blues records got this kind of a flat cardboard kind of a vibe going, you know, some of the ones that the new ones that come out, there's something missing. Like the performances are great, the songs are great, but there's something not right with the production, so everything else kind of falls by the wayside.
Yeah.
This record is going to blow your mind. It's called The Ice Queen. It's really good, man.
I got to check it out.
Yeah, she's great. She's really, really great. Well, man, thank you so much for coming on the show again. You are, I didn't even mention this in the beginning, this is episode 200 of the show.
Woo!
You are
awesome.
Episode 200. So,
well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And epic.
Yeah, and you were actually episode 93 back when. So, folks, if you want to go listen to that and then come listen to this, rock on. And, folks, go to gregkoch.com. That's K-O-C-H. That's how it's spelled.
Yes. And G-R-E-G, not with two G's.
Right, not two G's, right. Yeah. And the record's called Toby Arrives. It's on Mascot Label Group, which is amazing. What's coming off of that label? Oh, my God. It is really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the label I reached out to because I knew, I mean, because I've done, you know, last several records out on my own, which works fine. But I knew for this thing it needed a larger audience. And I knew as a guitar player and as a, you know, the best thing going internationally is the Mascot Label Group. And so when I said that to Ed, the head of the label, he got back to me right away. He's like, I got a new imprint coming out. It's all instrumental. It's called The Players Club. You guys will be the first release on it. This is perfect. I'm like, excellent. So it all panned out as glorious.
That's cool. That is really great. Well, you know, folks, what we're going to do is you already heard a chunk of Boogie Yourself, Dreid, but we're going to play the whole track as we go out here, and then we're going to take off. Greg, thanks so much for being on the show. And I will see
you. Thank you. It was my pleasure. Hope to see you soon. See you down in Texas.
I'll see you in Dallas.
You got it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and of course, on guitarradioshow.com.